Hello, welcome to, I think this must be the 14th or something, Millennial 2016 Hangout. This is with Porphyrogenitus. Now, Porphyrogenitus and I have been in touch for, well, nearly 3 years, because it was a few months after my channel started that he began emailing me. And he's sent me many, many emails, usually quite amusingly addressed and signed. And he sort of acted as a, well, how would you describe it? A sort of guru to me, yeah, throughout the channel's life. So it's nice to finally speak to him, because this is actually the first. Well, we spoke once, but I didn't actually know that it was you on a mumbler thing. But I didn't actually know that it was you, and I don't think we actually said that much to each other then. But anyway, this is the first time we've properly spoken to each other, and it's the first time that he has appeared on the channel. So, welcome, Porphyrogenitus. And can you first explain that name?
Oh, thank you. Well, first on the mumble, I hardly talk. So this is one of the reasons this is the first time I'm doing a podcast, is I hardly ever talk on a thing. But Porphyrogenitus is a name of it's not actually a name, it's a appellation. It's not a title, but it means born in the purple, and so I took that from Byzantine history, because I've always been interested in Byzantine history from reading actually old British historians like J.B. Bury, Stephen Runciman, starting with that kind of set. And I've had it before. I've been a member of the broad alt-right, just as an online name, but it also suits being less inclined to democracy. And the figure that I took it from is a Byzantine emperor named Constantine, who is Constantine the Seventh, and was the appellation of Porphyrogenitus was appended to his name because he was born in the Purple Room. And he was sort of a pedantic historian himself, so it sort of suits on that level too, as I'm kind of pedantic, and I have to admit that about myself.
Okay. All right. Well, so we're going to talk about, well, you have been, okay, one of the early on in our communication, you intimated to me that you had been involved in this sort of thing, the alt-right, before it was the alt-right, before it had even sort of coalesced into the thing that Richard Spencer launched. So why don't you describe that? If you, I think you were going back to about 2004, is that correct?
Yeah, 2004, but more on what became for a time neo-reaction, right? So I came in it from as many alt-writers do, you come in from a sort of, not you, the you in general, a libertarianish perspective, right? You come in rejecting the current modern structure, but not necessarily knowing what to call the next thing you want until, say, Richard Spencer came up with the term, or things coalesced around certain sort of anti-democratic ideas. And I would say that I wasn't certainly race conscious then, if we want to put it that way, although I never wanted to live in a country where my people were a minority, right? However you define that. And I think Morgoth touched on something there, but so I'll have to say too that I had conflicting strains. Like when I was in college as an undergrad, I also read Ben Wattenberg's book on the first universal nation, and I thought, hey, this, you know, if this worked out, this would be great. So you could call me sort of a cultural nationalist at that point. But I didn't think it would work out as long as multiculturalism is the thing. And multiculturalism is the thing. And for whatever reason, even the politicians who say it fails implement it, and it never got voted on. No people ever voted on, hey, we want to be dispossessed, we want to be the minority in our own country, and we want to be demonized. And that just, so I always recoiled against that, even when I was in Chokate, and would never have wanted to say I was like racially conscious, if again you want to use that phrase.
So okay, would you say that neo-reaction was your first, or your sort of entree into this, or was there something preceding that?
Well, I was blogging at the time, and mostly I was unfortunately blogging on what we might say the wrong side of the Iraq war issue, but also blogging on Anglosphere-ish stuff. there's this book, and now I can't remember the author's name, on the Anglosphere, and I am, again, I was more culturally into it, but this happens to be the White Dominions are the main key fulcrum of it. And sticking up for our civilization, but the problem is our civilization is obviously not embodied in people who don't share its roots or its ethnic consistency. And then, so what you get is this thing where, oh, all these other people want to come here just to be just like you. And then you find out when they get here, oh, they don't share your heroes. They don't share your past. They don't share your heritage. They don't share your ancestry. So we have to change our norms and our things. So it's obviously that's a whole bait and switch.
And it's also another type of bait and switch, because some of them do want to become just like us culturally. But the cost of that for us is that we have to be genetically altered.
We have to be genetically altered. And the whole thing that you had with, and now I'm forgetting his name, but the guest you had on for premillennial and said, well, you know, all this at bottom is like, well, anything you were attributing to ethnic or genetic makeup, he would say, well, there's got to be something else there. And we just have to get to the bottom of that and then bear the costs of elevating them up. You know, well, why should we have to bear those costs in our countries?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just a matter of, it's not just a matter of English language lessons.
It's the not fitting in generally. It's the not really wanting to fit in. It's the religious beliefs and mores just don't, they aren't the same.
Yeah, and it's their resentment at our being at home here. This is something I've touched on before, and it's not even an Islamic issue. It's got nothing to do with that. It's simply that their ancestors are not, well, it's simply that our ancestors are not their ancestors and can never be. And even at that base, at that sort of meeting point where they, well, let's say when they genetically mix with us, the deal there is that their kids will have some of our ancestors, but they will also have their ancestors. So there's a massive continuum being, changed forever, fundamentally, radically changed forever at that meeting point where, for example, a white guy race mixes with a brown woman. Now, they do, at that point, yeah, the kids' ancestors are British, going back thousands of years, but they're also, say, Pakistani. So it's a totally radical departure from this. And they can never have the same sense of loyalty to those ancestors or the same cultural mooring that I have, for example.
And you are correct, too. And like, I have another friend who's not in the alt-right as such, but is a Cornish friend. And he's into British history, English history, Cornish history. He was Celtic in part of its heritage. But he did all this research into this without even being part of a movement, this movement. And what he found supported his inclination was that up until very, very recently, the genetic stock of the British Isles, whatever we want to say about incursions of Norman rulers, whatever we want, you know, it's like it's basically stayed consistent going back to the beginning of recorded history. I mean, obviously people migrated into the British Isles at some point, but the people that have been there, even the stock is even pre-Celtic. The Celts were an overlay themselves on, you know, so it added some, but basically, like any intruder that conquered the Isles was a small fraction of the population, not 20-50%, and the stock hasn't changed considerably. And the thing that even when I was pre-racialist, pre-ethnic, what offended me was the idea that concerned about cultural genocide for anybody else except us. Well, why don't we have to work? Why don't we get to worry about our own homelands and defending our homelands and having what we might call a walled garden, a paradise, and let them do them over there, and we do us, you know?
Yeah. This is why, and you have commented on this in the emails. This tendency of mine. Other people have also sort of questioned this or berated me for it. I think it. I keep coming back to the genetics, the genes. I mean, I know it's culture. I know that culture is extremely important, and you can't just transplant someone from Australia back to Britain and say that they're now British just because they're genetically British. I know that culture is a huge thing here, but I just think that genetics is fundamental. You can't, in the end, it's what about us? What about this group? I don't give a fuck if these people who are from elsewhere, I don't care if they adopt our culture. I'd rather I'd like that. I mean, it's kind of flattering for them to do that, but let them do it in their own country. They don't have to come here, and because the price of that is that we are irreversibly altered as a group by their presence here, especially when they mix with us genetically. So this is why it's of such importance to me. I cannot understand why, with any other species, everyone understands the importance of genetics, but when it's human beings, even people in the alt-right, some of them, don't understand the importance of genetics. I mean, they think it's a cultural thing. Yeah, it is cultural, but below that, it's genetic.
Well, I will admit that I've come closer to your view. Maybe maybe we're moving in tandem in a similar direction, but you're always staying one step ahead in this sense, and that's why I'd almost like, I'm a little embarrassed when you say I've been your guru. Maybe that was early on, but I think you've spread your wings a little bit broader than that by this point. But I think it all works together in a way. I would not want our genetic stock to be absorbed any more than I would want, you know, than other people's would want theirs to be like wiped out. But I think also, and this comes to religion too, I mean, white people, your people of European descent are not all united by belief in, you know, Odin, but they are all united in belief in, or at least they were for about 2,000 years, 1,500 for some, united under Christendom. That's the faith that brought them together, and regardless of whether one believes in God or not, although I do, I think as long as Christendom was strong, the idea that, you know, Arab Muslims would come into the country and we would be they're just as good as you and I, the idea that all this, you know, that Indians and Chinese, regardless of whatever beliefs they have, could come in and they're all the same, would have seemed bizarre even without racial consciousness in the sense that developed. You know, that racial genetic consciousness developed as Christendom started to lose its sense as a concept. But unfortunately, I think people need to find their way back to faith, because I think genetic stock alone is not anything that will inspire unity. I think that if you want to put it in pragmatic terms, I'm not pragmatic about it at the bottom level, but there are pragmatic reasons why people adhere to faiths, and then the state is the protector of the faith. Like, some of the things on the alt-right that I disagree with is sort of the view taken from people like Julius Evola that religion exists to serve the state, and anything that does not support the state has to be eliminated from the belief, from the religious belief. I think it's exactly the opposite. I think state protects the faithful, and thus should be in accordance with the beliefs and religion of the people. And the beliefs and religion of the people also form both a material and spiritual bulwark against sort of intermingling with people who are not compatible and thinking that that's the same.
I mean, I didn't actually know that Evola had shared Mussolini's view of the state. That surprises me, because I really don't understand. I don't sympathize with that view at all. I think it's fucking insane to put the state above the people. I don't understand why you would. To me, the state is just an instrument to protect the people. If it's not doing that, then it's fucking pointless.
Right. Evola articulates that in his Fascism Viewed from the Right, where he's talking about the things he agrees with in Mussolini's vision, and then the things that he disagrees with. But one of the things he does clearly indicate agreement with is that, you know, the state is the central key, and
Everything. Well, I guess he could be. Yeah, I'd have to read it. I haven't read, believe it or not, everyone, I haven't read Evola, and it's a mark of embarrassment for me. But I can imagine he might have said that he might have envisaged the state as something more meaningful than just a system of bureaucracies.
Oh, yeah. He takes that, more sacred than that from before, but it's also like it's more sacred than the people itself in a way to him. But I haven't read all of Evola, so I don't want to go too much into thinking I'm an Evola expert, but it struck me and some of the others that were reading Fascism Viewed from the Right at the same time that he put that at the key, and then that the beliefs had to be subordinated, whereas I still think it's the reverse, because one of the problems with Evola, among others, is something Morgoth was talking at the end of your... I wanted to get to... on hyper-individualism. So a lot of people on the alt-right think that our problem is liberty, or, you know, people having too much freedom, and in a way that's true, but on the other hand, we don't really, like you're experiencing right now, we don't really live in an era where there's a lot of individual liberty. We just live in an era where people mouth it as a platitude while they crush them in the name of egalitarian things. But the problem with modernity is something that Jim Kalb has written eloquently about, is the Enlightenment foundation was based on a view of individuals defined by the characteristics they have in common with all others, rather than individuals defined on those characteristics they have in particular to themselves, which is also why you have the cultural libertarians who basically agree in some sense with the social justice warriors that, well, we could all just be the same in one country if only we get rid of this particular. And how can you possibly think that a Chinese person or an Indian person or an Arab isn't just like you? Because like when Hobbes set up his description of the state, nothing in Leviathan would indicate that this society is for a particular people, rather than this society is formed around the state and applies to all people anywhere in the world.
Okay.
It's a peculiar philosophical anthropology.
Sorry, I'm distracted by the chat. I'm trying to work out who to ban, because it looks like there's a lot of bullshit going on, but I don't know. Hold on a second. Well, it has always seemed to me for the last few years that the state is an invention, it's an apparatus, and it's something that I think, and you see this with the NHS in Britain, people want to have faith in it, they want to love it, and they want to care about it because it's something that we have built, and I suppose it's something transcendent as well, because it's going, in the strict sense that it's going to outlast you and me, and it might have it goes beyond our births in history. It goes back beyond before we were born. So it's something big that you can devote yourself to. And you see this with the Nazis as well. You know, it was a state that people could worship and have faith in. But I don't think with the Nazis it was the case that the state existed just for its own sake, and the German people were its slaves to keep the state going. It was the other way around. That the Nazi state existed, the Third Reich existed, precisely to sustain, protect, preserve the German people. Right. Yeah, the Volk, exactly. Which seems to be a more... See, now that I say it, I can see the shortcomings with it, because you're worshipping the material, the genetic, whereas the state is a sort of abstract project that people can and do, clearly do, invest faith in.
But they're doing it because it's sort of the modern state, at least, of which, you know, the National Socialists in Germany were both trying to get away from while also still being affected by modernity. But the modern state is an artificial transcendent thing. So this gets back to the sort of civic nationalism that you decry. It's like, and I think you decry it rightly, because Civic nationalism. Okay, what is Canadian civic nationalism? Canadian civic nationalism is, oh, we're open and tolerant and inclusive, and we all treat each other equally. Okay, how does that differ from Swedish civic nationalism? How does that that's the same thing with the Schengen zone, where, okay, you have a European passport and somebody moves in and they're supposed to be a civic nationalist and just as German as you. They step across the border into France and they're also supposed to be just as French as the person in France, right? Because they have the passport. If they get the passport. There's an emptiness to it.
This is a level of state power. This is when the state has been elevated to such an extent that it only has to grant someone a piece of paper, and it can alter them in some metaphysical way, so that a Nigerian is suddenly a Frenchman. I mean, that is just crazy.
But it's also empty. It's empty at the bottom, and that's part of the point, is that it's empty. Because if you cross the one border to another border and the state grants you this mystical, like, ding on the head, like Tinkerbell, but they're all the same, all the Western governments, like, their civic nationalism is defined in the same way. Well, like, no wonder people find it wanting and look around for other things too. Cause it's just an identity then. It's just not an identity in the true sense, but it's a philosophical same.
It's a piece of paper.
Yeah.
It's a contract.
To believe the same things, which are this empty.
I just said that was a contract, but even that isn't enough. It's not even a contract, because nothing is demanded of the person except that they pretend to subscribe to certain beliefs.
Right. Well, one of the guys on TRS put it pithily, and I think it was Mike. He said, "Well, has anybody in the world ever gained U.S. citizenship because the ding somewhere in the world they started believing these values? And did anybody ever lose it because they stopped believing it? No. I mean, it's just some kind of, like, it's very artificial. It's an artificial mysticism.
Yes. Yes, it is. You see, the thing is, that has been sustainable for, well, sustainable, and it has felt sustainable for 70 years. Right. But I think with the migrant crisis especially, it was starting to fall apart, undoubtedly, even before then. But then the migrant crisis really brought it into focus, not just because of the after effects, like Cologne and so on, but even the fact of it, that you've got a river of men, you know.
A literal river, yeah.
Yeah, coming through a German village, and they are now to be regarded as Germans. And when you see it in that volume, You can't. I just don't know how anyone can be blind to the lie of it. I mean, it's monstrous.
I think it was sustainable before this crisis and before this huge bulge of immigration, in part because, though the explicit thing that we were all supposed to believe for the last 40 years was the civic nationalism, at bottom, underneath all that, Germans were German, right? Underneath all that, English were Englishmen. Underneath all that, we were all, if not Christian, we came from a Christian heritage that was still extant, even if it had collapsed in the wake of World War I, started to crumble, let's put it that way, in the way that you've put it pithily in some of your videos. These were not the things that we were supposed to make a big deal about, but these things were still in the heart of the people. But as you bring in people who never had that in their heart, never had that, never held that, the seems becoming more and more apparent, because, and this is the problem, one of the things that does happen, I think happens a lot in human history, is the implicit loses out to the explicitly articulated. And so the things that meant that in the past, like, okay, there have been Palestinian refugees for how many 40 years, but they never thought they could just stream into Europe, right? They started to stream into Europe, not the Palestinians, but the other refugees, because the implicit did lose out or to the explicit in Europe recently, say within the last 10 years, to the point where the governing classes have lost any sense of the national identity as a separate thing and just believe the same stuff that they were all taught in the high, you know, the upper middle class, high class universities they've all gone to.
And the international schools and so on.
Right. Which is this sort of, like, global. And so, like, even a left-wing politician in the past, like a Bill Clinton, would never have, like, even if he wanted to, which maybe he did want to, but he knew he would never be able to get get away with saying, well, we're going to let in every Arab who feels they want to come here. And even Tony Blair in the 90s would not have done what, you know, the Labour government started to do in the teens and in the aughts. They had some...
Well,
I know the whole story of what they did with, like, we're going to rub the right's nose in diversity, and they did increase immigration, but they never...
Did it overtly. I mean, that had to be done in secret. That was from, I think that was from 98 onwards, or maybe even 97, the year they got voted in.
The whole stream of Somalis would just not have been sent in, like millions of Somalis. Like, some tens of thousands were settled in the same in the U.S., and it has had a bad effect. You know, Minnesota was turned from a clean government place to a place where senatorial seats can be basically openly stolen, right? I mean... So that's what happened in Norwegian, Scandinavian Minnesota, right? Which had this reputation for clean government and is now like a corrupt cesspool. But
this is what Greg Johnson has alluded to. This, you know, this is the run on an individualist model where you trust everyone, and then some other group comes in that are quite happy to work collectively and corruptly. Then they'll do it, and you're fucked.
Right. That's that comes from those papers on the.
Well, it's ethnocentrism.
Ethnocentric cooperation. Yeah, basically ethnocentric cooperation is advantaged over individualism, and even social science, which is otherwise a corrupt field.
Yes.
Has found that, you know, ethnocentric cooperation works both in like game theoretical models and in the works of like Putnam, who tried to hide it for decades, but well, not decades.
That's, I think, like 5 or 6 years he tried to hide it.
Right. And then other papers have come out. So when somebody poo-poos you, for example, for mentioning, oh, well, that's one paper. Well, other papers have found basically the same thing. And okay, they have also had findings that, well, other people move into these diverse cities and they like it. Well, you get a sorting in London. Like, the left, Labour is supposed to care about the poor, right? But the Cockneys have been wiped out of their part of London. We people are so mean that we peacefully leave rather than hanging on to our homeland. So the Cockneys are all dispersed, right? And they're going to be dead as a group. Because
I think they already are at this stage.
Yeah. Well, individuals are alive, but they're all scattered. They're not a group anymore. So in that sense, they're wiped out. Yeah.
Well, the group that we called Cockneys doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, of course there are individuals, but they're mostly scattered. The East End of London, which used to be their habitat, world.
Yeah. It's
completely vibrant now. So they've been dispersed outside of London, Essex, and so on. They simply don't exist as a group anymore. Right.
Not as a group, yeah.
No. And even Essex, where they fled to, and these other places, even they are now being enriched. Yeah. So, you know, it's a fucking terrible story. It's... if you want an indication of what mass immigration leads to, you should look at the story of the London Cockney, who simply does not exist anymore. And I think that this is something that people don't like to admit. And of course, the example of London is so instructive. You know, this is when it's now 45. Well, it was 5 years ago. God knows what it is now. 5 years ago, it was 45%. White British, and only one in five school children in inner London was white, was native. That's 5 years ago. It must be even less now. So, if you give that example to people, it's a very, very stark example of what this is leading to, which is destruction of a group at the genetic level, the cultural level, the social level, and even the political level, because they don't have any political representation anymore. They don't exist anymore, so why would they? But it was that was implemented in the first place because they didn't have any political representation. It was there was no one fighting for them,
right?
So total destruction.
The working people of, and I hate to say class, but the working people of our countries all of our countries have basically been betrayed by the parties that supposedly represented them and have turned to this identity politics as a substitute. But because the real left, the intellectual class left, I think what they did is by the 60s, they realized that the working people who were their base, the base of the Labor Party, the base of the Democratic Party, the base of the left parties in all the Western countries, were never going to go full bore for even Fabianism. They were interested in programs that would elevate them out of, you know, destitution if they lost their job, if the plant left. But as soon as they got a safety net, what used to be called a safety net, they were fine and they weren't looking for social revolution, whereas the real intellectuals were. And so multiculturalism was the next step, right? Because we'll make an alliance of the fringes, as others have called it. And
I think that also multiculturalism was made inevitable and unavoidable by mass immigration. Because if you had mass immigration into a very strong state, they would just have to conform. They would have to adopt that culture to whatever extent they could.
Well, the problem
when you put them into, you know, 20th century Europe, that was a society that was just spiritually dying. And so they couldn't impose that culture on them. And so multiculturalism was an inevitable attempted solution. Of course, as we've found out, it doesn't work. It's not a solution.
I think, though, for a lot of Western countries, like one of the things I think somebody who's really good at research should try to look into and not just go to the quick answers like some sinister cabal did it, is why all the Western countries within about a 5-year period adopted multiculturalism as a sort of official stance, even if quietly so. And this was for many of these countries well before they started with mass immigration. So it's like they looked to the United States and saw, oh, look, you have an ethnic minority underclass, and all we have is our white, underclass. And wouldn't it be nice to have that to use as a tool to whip people with? It's like, oh, and so everybody and their uncle started importing people from places that maybe they had some. I mean, like, there's the Empire Windrush, and there's the situation that Enoch Powell warned about growing, but it was still relatively small, which is why he could give his warning at the time without. I mean, you look at British shows of even, well, I guess it's closing in on 20 years now, but there was no obsession, of course, with having diversity, because there wasn't nearly as much. There were pockets in key areas that were problem areas because the pockets were there, but most of Britain didn't have to experience it, right?
No, and no one
got me wrong.
I mean, yeah, it was a case that you weren't. No one wanted to be openly racist, but it wasn't something that you were expected to celebrate. I mean, I would say that started late 90s, maybe even later than that.
Right.
I mean, the word diversity, I don't think I ever heard that at school. I don't remember that word.
I did, though. And Canada has had official multiculturalism for a couple. That really started with Trudeau, not Justin, but Pierre Trudeau, is like, we're going to be a multicultural country. And so, Sweden moved in that well before they had a lot of immigrants, right? They were, well, we want to be open and tolerant and multiculti. And so, and they call it multiculti. And Germany has had that. And I guess their excuse would be, well, we had these Turkish workers. But they didn't have a policy of everybody's a German and we're just going to import hundreds of thousands to millions to, why should you care if you're a minority? Every Swede is a Muslim with a beard, right? I mean,
yeah. I mean, it's I don't know. You'd have to go into the history of each country to determine whether it adopted multiculturalism first or latterly after. I think definitely in Britain's case, without a doubt, it was after. They adopted mass immigration first, or they allowed that, they accepted that. And then that caused problems. Immigrants didn't want to integrate. And so around about 1980, although maybe the mid-70s mid-70s to 1980, then they adopted multiculturalism because they thought that would be a solution. Then the immigrants could retain their cultures and their identities. Their ancestral identity.
That's a disaster waiting to happen right there, though. I mean, that's just But my sense,
though, you understand. Sorry,
the immigrant population are so small. You know what I mean? And like, so I've read some of the intellectual history in the form of like people like Charles Taylor writing about like, you know, identity and stuff like that. And Charles Taylor is this Canadian philosopher, and he positioned himself as sort of a moderate middle, even though to me he's on the far left of things. And they're writing about this at a time when the populations are relatively small, but they're seeking it as a goal to have others retain their identities before there's really a critical mass of them. So then you get the thing where the immigration really ramps up. So like Swedish immigration really ramped up high starting in the 90s. They had some earlier, but it wasn't that much. I looked at the chart, and it ramps up obviously in parallel to rape rates and violent crime rates. I mean, the parallel of those lines on the graph are, you know, I mean, the correlation is so high that you'd have to be a moron not to accept it. Or willfully blind, which most of our intellectual class is willfully blind, because they want to believe things that just aren't true. And multiculturalism is also, I think the way you put it makes it sound almost innocuous, that, well, the immigrants came and they didn't want to assimilate. They wanted to keep their identities as raving lunatics calling for jihad. So we're going to let them have multiculturalism, and that's going to calm them down rather than have them see it as a conquering place. Whereas I think the goal of the left has been to deconstruct Western civilization for a while, for at least 40 years.
Just before you get into that, what you just said, back then in 1975 to 1980, I don't think that we in the West were frightened of Islam at all. I mean, the idea of jihadis or jihadism, I don't know if there was any awareness of that, certainly not in the public. Because Islam had just been dormant, dead for decades, since 1918 with the fall of the Ottoman Empire. So there was nothing. I mean, yeah, there was in the when did the Iranian, I think it was 1978, the Iranian Revolution. So that would have been cause for some concern. But even then you'd think, well, there are hardly any of them here in Britain. They seem quite docile. So why shouldn't they be allowed to keep their eye? I mean, I can understand why the public just, to the extent that they were even consulted on this or even aware of this, I can understand
why
they went along with it. They would have heard the terms, you know, multicultural. I don't know when that first came into. See, again, you don't know when these things came into use. I mean, I know when it was brought in as official policy. It was after the Brixton riots, 1981. But I don't know when the public were told this stuff. When did they first hear multicultural?
There's a very interesting BBC documentary that I think it aired after the 2007 bombings, the train bomb. Those were the train bombings, right? In 2007.
Yeah, that was 2005. It was 2005. It was the 7th of July, 2005.
Okay, that's right. Anyway, they put together a documentary on the Powell speech, on Enoch Powell's speech. That's an hour long with some of the usual kind of BBC condescension towards Powell, and some of the, you know, vibrant people being interviewed. But then they had one dude who was a Labour MP, a relatively youngish MP, but clearly he actually represented the British working class constituency. And that documentary is very good, actually, especially the last 5 minutes, which YouTube took the last like 6 minutes off. Otherwise, you could find the rest on YouTube up until recently. But it mentioned, you know, it was sort of a bipartisan consensus that we were going to do this thing, but we weren't going to talk about it in front of quote unquote the children, meaning the population, right? So it was just a consensus among the British rule, what you'd call the ruling elites of both parties, that like we were going to sideline Powell because Heath was in charge. You know what Heath was? As a conservative, he wasn't very conservative, but no conservatives really end up being conservative.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to work out. Was it Roy Jenkins?
It probably was him. That name sounds very familiar. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So he said that they agreed they were going to do this behind closed doors, basically.
Right, and not talk about it in front of, you know, the public, because the British working classes were not really, that's why they supported Powell until he got demonized enough that they didn't, is they weren't keen on having their neighborhoods intruded upon by people who would basically want handouts without having been part of Britain. And in whatever sense one might say, I'm not a real big supporter of welfare statism, but you can at least say that if your family has lived there for generations and been a coal miner and worked, that in some sense the society taking care of you is you are actually part of it, right? Whereas somebody who just arrived and gets a card to be on benefit is not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they don't belong anyway, because like you said, regardless of whether it's genetics or culture, they're not trying to fit in. We're expecting to accommodate.
No.
It's like your mayor said recently, and you had a whole thing on it, but the mayor of London is like, oh, well, we're not here to integrate. The goal should be society accommodate us. Well, that's invasion.
Yeah, it is. It's of a soft variety, but nonetheless, yeah, that's what it is. And crucially, the British public were never, ever asked about this. It's just infuriating. But what you were going to... I interrupted you. You were going to say that the left has been... The goal of the left has been to dismantle Western culture.
Right. Well, ever since sort of overt, you know, Marxism or even the Fabian socialism didn't seem to work out, they've been looking for excuses, and they decided on the, you know, what's called cultural Marxism. That's why when these, you know, Frankfurt School intellectuals migrated during the war, it was them, not say Mises or Rothbard, even, who wasn't a migrant, but Mises was a migrant and Hayek was a migrant. While some people looked to those ideas, which became the kernel of libertarianism, it was Adorno, it was Gramsci, it was, you know, the writings of Marcuse, it was all that the left latched onto, along with people like Wilhelm Reich, in order to, this is our next thing. This, A, explains why Orthodox Marxism wasn't adopted, and B, these writings and the writings of people of, like, Lukács earlier, which was, you know, incorporated into the Frankfurt School kind of system of thought, if you call it that, explain why. And it's Western civilization, right? It's the civilization that creates this culture that protects the capitalist structure, and we need to dismantle that before we can have this egalitarian utopia. And this is why, too, Tony Blair could truthfully say when he altered the Labour Manifesto to take out, what was it, Clause 5? I can't remember which clause, but...
I think it was Clause 4, if I recall correctly.
You're right, yeah. And so he altered the clause about ownership of production, but he said, no, we're still pursuing the same goal. But because the goal was... People confuse Marxism with the ownership of the means of production, but the goal of Marxism is that is just a means. The goal is this sort of egalitarian, classless society. And Blair and the Blairites, for all their compromises with neoliberalism, their goal was still an egalitarian, classless society where everybody, not just in Britain, but everybody in the world is exactly the same, right?
Yeah. Well, except for them.
Right, of course. The nomenclatura always exempts itself, right? Yeah. The global, the transnational governing class is a special elite, right? And they just see themselves as above and outside of the normal run of humanity, without consciously thinking that, but they really do. They're sort of a caste that sees ahead, so it's like it's vanguardism.
Yeah, I think it is. I think they must always see themselves as separate, because I don't think they would ever want for themselves and their own children what they advocate for everyone else. So unless they're making some sort of vicarious sacrifice through their children and grandchildren, then they must intend to always remain separate from the hoi polloi and always insulated from the things that the hoi polloi must suffer as a result of their policies. They must intend to always remain separate. I don't know whether that's actually feasible or not, but I think that must be in their thinking.
I think it's more subconscious than conscious, but I also think that you're right, and this is why they find it easy to ally with certain groups that, you know, others would put echoes around without them being echoey themselves, although a high proportion are, but that's because they all get together. But the global elites of Western society do see themselves as transnational, and in a way they are. I think you've talked about this before, about some of, at the very top end of all the Western countries, the elites who rule it have more in common culturally even at this point with each other than they have with the people of their own country.
Yeah.
They watch the same things. They meet at the same Davos-style meetings.
Yeah, they go to the same international schools. I mean, people will say that this has happened before, and in different ways. Like, for example, that the Russian aristocracy spoke French.
Right.
For example, yes, okay, that happened, and no, and for what it's worth, I wouldn't be surprised if that played some role in their feeling of detachment from the peasants and the serfs. Maybe it did. Let's not pretend that it's an okay thing just because it's happened before. But either way, the force with which it's happening now is something else, because you get leaders who really do think that they have no loyalty at all to the peoples of, for example, Britain or Germany or Austria or France or anywhere.
They have loyalty to their movement, and then you're a traitor if you're not part of the movement.
They have loyalty to other people like themselves, which is, not surprising. That's human nature. But it's of a toxic kind of variety because it's so detached from normal life.
Well, it's toxic on many dimensions, and I think you're right to connect it to, usually when it's happened before, it has quite often led to disaster, like the Russian aristocracy speaking French and being cosmopolitan meant that they were also partly blinded to what was going on in their own society, and what the particular needs of their own society wasn't the same as the needs of a French society. So getting your advice from the French or Prussian monarchs wasn't necessarily good. If you were then detached so completely from, in some ways it worked. Like, it's always good for a Peter the Great to get some ideas from abroad and then lift his people up. But it's also, the downside is if you get so cosmopolitan that you're detached, then,
The downside is if you get so cosmopolitan that you just don't care anymore. And I really think that's the situation that our current elites are in. I think they have no sense of loyalty to...
Oh, they definitely don't.
Yeah, to the British. I mean, I think of someone like Nick Clegg, and I think he has a very... And this is something I mentioned in those videos that you referred to. I think they have a very trivial attitude towards culture, actually. Not just race or ethnic, just even culture. I think they have a very shallow attitude. They think it's just something that people do. It's like an activity. It's like a group activity that you might encourage some 3-year-olds at kindergarten to engage in some culture. We're going to do culture for the next half hour, kids. That seems to be their attitude.
Well, they see it as superficial and malleable. It's a social construct, so they can reconstruct it anytime they want, and they won't have people rebelling against them. But I think that it's not even, at least in America, for a long time, and this is what moved me from, like, I grew up in a city where basically everybody is at least a moderate liberal, if not a leftist. And, it's a small college city capital, but since my youth, I have noticed that the people who are on the left, the intellectual left, or people who are associated with the university in some way, their attitude wasn't that they didn't care about the people in the rest of the country. Their attitude was contempt, resentment, which is not uncaring. It's a very bad kind of, like, it's like you're locked in a marriage where you have contempt and resentment for your spouse and children. And that's a road to destruction for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, do you want to get onto the matter of the alt-right? Because that was, I'm starting to get tired, so I'm aware of it. No. I'm not going to be able to go much longer. I wanted to ask you, because you have this, I think you have a slightly broader perspective than a lot of people in the alt-right itself, including me, about the historical sort of context in which the alt-right has emerged. So would you like to talk about that briefly? Because I think you introduced me to the philosopher, I've forgotten his first name. Is it Edward Fesser?
Edward Fesser, yeah.
Fesser.
Well, yeah, I think it's actually pronounced Fesser, but I always pronounce names wrong. I'm terrible. I think you're correct that it's more pronounced Fesser. Mm. And what he was, although he's moved on from this himself, is he was also a libertarian, but this is earlier in his career. But he had been an atheist, and reading and then teaching some of the older philosophers like Aristotle and Aquinas, especially those two, drew him back into faith. But he was also a libertarian in the, like, he was the opposite of a cultural libertarian. So he has this article, I think it's still up at Mises.org, on what libertarianism. And any one of us who read that article on what libertarian isn't would say, that's absolutely correct. Libertarianism is not free the nipple. It's not libertinism. It's basically, it's not cultural libertarianism. And he was never an anarcho-libertarian, but anyway, he moved away from that more towards a sort of Catholic Christendom perspective as he returned to the Catholic faith. And but it's an attitude that does treat, because the whole underpinnings of that too is what libertarian isn't, is about, well, if you tear down these sort of social institutions in the name of egalitarianism and in the name of libertinism and everybody should do exactly what they want, you're making a bigger state inevitable, which I think is one reason why the people who control governments, they love both cultural libertarianism, if you want to put it that way, and social justice warrior movements, because both of those movements are giving them gifts. So you get the phenomenon of Gary Johnson, who was the libertarian presidential candidate this year and had no problem with the state saying, you know, what you have to do in your business life, which is basically you have to be forced to associate with others. But my view is still, it still remains more sympathetic to the Edward Facer view that, like you talked in this chat with me about, well, you're going to get this behemoth state that's at the center of everything if you start tearing down the more substantive background institutions of culture, of civilization, where...
Yeah, well, this is how what Morgoth was saying. You're going to end up with the guy with an assault rifle keeping people from killing each other at Boxing Day sales.
Because all the norms that keep people, that allow actual liberty, and this is also why a lot of alt-rightists have turned on liberty, happens when all these expected norms of behavior are stripped away, which is what actually sustained a free society to the extent to which we had free societies in the past. I mean, it's not like in Britain you have more free speech now under this sort of libertine society, but because all the other things, the things that Theodore Dalrymple writes about, that all the other private sort of institutions that sustain a people, sustain a culture, sustain relationships have been stripped away. So you have hyper-individualism where the connections to each other are so weak that the only mediator is a state, you know, is a social worker, is a policeman, you know, is some sort of authority backed by the state, whether it be those figures or quangos, you know, or anti-fa groups invested with, like, money from, you know, given to them by governments across Europe, you know, eavesdropping on people, because the expected norms of behavior have all been denigrated, slashed, and burned away.
Yeah. There has been this dissolution of things that people used to just... I think people took a lot for granted. I mean, right. Nowadays, we think... Like, even the word white, right? People are correct when they say that we didn't need this concept of whiteness 100 years ago, because it was so much the default. We could take it completely for granted. The English are supreme in England. They're virtually exclusive. That, you know, they virtually have total domination of that land. The same with the French in France and so on. So you just didn't need to have this concept of the white race. And you also didn't really need to have the concept of, well, of even the English race. I mean, I think, or the Scottish race. And, you know, people were aware of it only in the context of the world. So when England interfaced with the world, it was the English race, the English people. Right. But it wasn't, you know, in daily life, it wasn't important because it didn't need to be. And in other ways too, I think that people took comfort for granted, as you would. You know, it's human nature. You don't think about a possible grand context in which this could all be pulverized. You don't think like that. But now,
the exact analog in at least one sense is directly to the concept of conservatism. Nobody forms a conservative movement until what you have is under assault by something else, some radical position, right? And so this isn't to say that, well, this is like exactly overlapping, though. We as people who find conservatism, mainstream conservatism, as wanting, as obviously failed, as retreating at every step and never conserving, there's nothing left to conserve, which is why we have an alt-right, because the mainstream right is just the left. Now, it used to be the mainstream right was the left of 20 years ago. Now it's to the point where it's the left of 4 years ago in the United States. I mean, the mainstream commentators were decrying Trump's position on immigration in the same way that the left was decrying Romney's 4 years ago. So the acceleration towards the left has increased. But,
oh, yeah. Well, even in Britain, you know, it was a conservative government that brought in gay marriage. So you could say that they're even ahead of they're actually competing.
The freak flag fly, you know, on gay celebration days all over, you know, British consulates and everything. They're going to have the rainbow flag is permitted now under Boris Johnson's, you know.
And so I think you could say that the mainstream right is now competing with the left to be more, well, leftist, really.
They're both liberal and left in the philosophical sense, even if they're left right on a very narrow political spectrum.
That's the irony, and the economics turns out to be kind of trivial. And it's easy for me to say that because I'm not good at economics. I'm not interested in economics. But I really do think that it's just of minor importance compared to other issues, namely culture, peoplehood, race, and so on.
Well, the mainstream parties hardly differ on economics anymore either. I think economics is important in the broader scheme of things, but when it comes to political arguments, since the left gave up nationalizing industry and the right has given up really, in most cases, deregulating and stuff like that, it's just a matter of who featherbeds whose nest and maybe a 5% change in tax rates, right? And maybe slightly slower or faster spending. Their differences are not big enough to be momentous in elections, which is why elections are fought over what all the mainstream people think are trivial reasons, but they have to do. They're wrapped up in identity. I mean... You know, well, who has to bake a cake for who when you have X beliefs in America may seem as a trivial issue, but is the importance of are you going to be able to practice what you believe or not, or are you going to be forced to do something? So it elevates the trivial issues into major things.
Well, because it means
trivial. At bottom, they're huge because it's going to determine which way the country goes.
Yeah, and you just put it that way, that are you going to be able to practice your beliefs? I would put it this way. Are you going to be able to continue your peoplehood?
Right. Well, and ultimately, all these things coalesce into that, and I think you're right on that. I wouldn't boil it all down to genetics, but I would also say that genetics is a part of it.
Whether you're going to be forced to bake a gay cake or not, that does not have an effect on your genetics. That is a cultural thing, but it's wrapped up in your peoplehood.
Right. Well, this is why ultimately, like, I think your focus on immigration and the issues having to do with Rotherham are key, because even I, who would rather just focus on non-genetic things, once we get absorbed into other people's genetics, that's it. It's over. But anything else is theoretically recoverable from. Like, if we have an economic collapse without the barbarian invasion of Arabs, well, we live among ruins for a while, then we clean ourselves up and dust ourselves off and we move on. If we get absorbed into other people's, well, that's it. We're done. We're just gone forever, right? I mean...
Yes. This is why I keep going on about it. You know, even cultural dissolution could be recovered from, in the way that Eastern Europe is now recovering very slowly from the assault of communism.
Right.
In the end, they're still going to exist. They'll be traumatized for generations, but they're still going to exist, and therefore they will have the opportunity, if not the means, they will at least have the opportunity to recover everything that they were beforehand. But if you've been genetically changed, then you can't. You just can't go back unless you're going to have very advanced genetic engineering, which we don't have.
And that's why I think even IQ fetishism about genetic differences in IQ at bottom isn't the thing in and of itself, even though it's an important difference. But somebody wrote into one of the blogs that I occasionally read, but this was some months ago, so I can't remember which one. But, you know, a Chinese person had written into this blogger and said, hey, if you guys are really big on white people having higher IQs than Arabs and Africans, then you why do you mind if the Chinese colonize the west coast of America? And like, and the way it was put was like really as a question, or not a rhetorical question, but the thing is we do care if we're ruled by foreigners, right? Regardless of whether the Chinese IQ as measured in certain measures is 2 points or 5 points or even 20 points higher, which it isn't 20 points higher. There are other differences, and there's differences within types of IQ. I mean, I don't like emotional intelligence, but the Chinese are maybe better at certain types of thinking, but that doesn't mean they're better at all types of thinking. There are things that you've gone into about the differences in creativity, for example, that we have.
Yeah, and also the differences in compassion. I really think that, I mean, some people doubt that whites are more that whites have what we call pathological altruism. I think they do. And I think that they have that because they also have a lesser thing, which is just compassion. I think that whites are just generally more compassionate and more interested in the greater good, in social justice of whatever variety. I think whites are obsessed with these things.
Many things are a double-edged sword, and like both our strength as a people and what is being used and what is being adopted that is also destroying us is, okay, we have a broader compassion than many peoples around the world in that it's very easy for any peoples to have in-group kin compassion, where we're more open to compassion for people who like are not obviously related to us, right? Which is, it's a strength in a way because it allows us to be even-handed, but it's being used as well. What's wrong with adopting an African baby into all of your families, right? Yeah. Instead of having your own children, right? I mean, in many things, like IQ is a strength and a weakness in and of itself. Like raw intelligence, there's no obvious correlation between intelligence and wisdom. So you can get, and this is what people say about certain groups, a certain group, is they use their high verbal to manipulate people rather than to be better people, right? Well, there's a lot of whites who do that too and happen to rule us because they're smart enough to go to the good schools, right? But it doesn't mean that they're better people.
No, I completely agree. This is a problem. This is a very complex question about intelligence. The intelligence, wisdom, and goodness.
Yeah.
These are three completely different things. And it's true. It sounds pious or sort of earnest to say this, but it's true that some of the best people I've known have not been very intelligent, and some of the worst people I've known have been very intelligent.
One of the smugness of our intellectual cast, be they like the sort of irony brothers on the TV shows where they're snarking at people who are poorer than them, who happen to be poorer than them, but are just, they don't share the political beliefs, is why they're snarking along through the bright commentators, is they'll point to this or that politician whose views happen to agree with them and call that person intelligent, and then their personal inference is that also means that they have all the other good qualities, right? That they're wise, they're compatible, because they're so smart and read the same books as me.
Yeah. I think this is part of the cosmopolitan mentality, because the thinking is, well, this guy's intelligent. He can probably handle all of these different situations, and he's probably read all of these different books. And that is their version of culture. That's their conception of culture. So and therefore wisdom. It's the only sort of font of wisdom is to be cosmopolitan. And yeah. And you're better at being cosmopolitan if you're intelligent, because you can handle different things. You can adapt. So I think this is where it all comes from.
That's possibly true. I don't want to disagree. I can't think of a reason to, but I haven't thought about it that way. So I'm reluctant to say.
Neither have I. Only just occurred to me now.
This is my pedantic side showing, though, where it's like I'll have to think about that one more. I think there's a lot to that without being complete. I've grown more complex in my own thinking after, and now everybody knows of Jordan Peterson because he's fighting at least a good fight against. I mean, it's what we would call an anti-SJW issue, because he's against PC, but he's fighting a good fight, and for somebody who's a tenured professor, he's really good. But I have been recommending, and I think I even recommended to you, his book and videos.
Maps of Meaning.
Right, because it's so good on it. It has helped me connect some ideas that were in Showcade in my own head, as well as expand my my views on what religion does in sort of the pragmatic sense, as in addition to what I think is true, like actually true, and the depths to culture that I always thought was important. But like you said, like our intellectual cast looks at culture in like superficial sense, like the joke about, well, we get all these new restaurants if only we open ourselves up. And that's the depth of culture, is people have some trivial holiday, right? And people have like some interesting dress, and maybe speak a little bit, but there's nothing more to it than that. But there turns out to be a lot more to it than that. Like we carry, whether we know it in our or not, whether we're consciously aware of it or not, I mean, in our heads. And this is why, like, the older civilizations, the pre-Enlightenment civilizations, had a more correct view of things. We carry in our heads the entire legacy of our past in such a way that piety to our ancestors, not worship, but piety towards our ancestors is important, because all that has accumulated to form us exactly as we are. And it includes the genetic stuff, but it also even includes experiential stuff beyond that have shaped the way we do things in ways that we have often forgotten. So that's the problem of tacit knowledge, is it's the unarticulated things we talked about 20 minutes, 30 minutes ago, that now we're losing a sense of the importance of, because it's not articulated. It's just things that we knew to do without having it consciously in the forefront of our mind.
Yes, yes. Well, we're in this stage where everything has to be justified on a utilitarian basis, because we don't have an ethnic connection, or we don't believe in ethnic connection. So right. At that stage, anything can be deconstructed. You know, at that stage, anything can be just wasted away. Anything right. can be dismantled, discredited. Yeah. And that's the problem. If you're going to adopt this rationalist mindset, I don't think it's natural to people. I think it's, and this is what I was getting at in the NPI speech, you know, it's an affectation. But it does make you feel damn clever.
Right. Well, that's where the work of people like Jonathan Haidt come in, and where the philosophy of Alistair MacIntyre kind of cross over is, and this intersects with Jordan Peterson too, because reason, in a way, Hume was right. Reason is the servant, not of the passions, but of all the other things that organize things conceptually. So Hume was sort of incomplete in himself in saying reason just exists to serve the passions, the emotions. But reason is the sort of second angel in heaven, if you want to put it that way, because that's what Satan is associated with having been, is the rational calculator. But it was supposed to be under this conception of how do we even cognitively be aware of the surroundings around us and organize our lives in such a way that we can make reason out what to do next. Because it's not like the world, there's a reality to the world, but how we perceive things is very different from just material substance, because our eyes, our mind has to make simplifications and put things into categories that are pre-rational. Like, what you decide to put in a category is not a matter of rational calculation. That's a cognition that comes before you reason about what to do with it completely. And that varies probably by genetics, but also by cultural norms, which is why you get two different incompatibilities when people come who have completely different mindsets about things.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's bring this onto the topic at hand, which is the alt-right. I want you to talk about that in relation to the last sort of 10 years. What do you think? How would you define the alt-right if you had to?
It's difficult because there's like, and now it's become even more difficult. So, for example, when I was talking to you about ways to conceive of the alt-right, that was before the concept of the alt-light formed, you know, the Milos of the world, the people who are like, were hangers-on. And so now it's harder for me to talk about the broader conception without like having it leak over into that, which is like a whole nother thing of people who are like cultural libertarians in the way that I guess I used to be, but never was completely, because I was never a cultural libertine. So how to define it is a little bit more difficult, but in my conception, it included things that have split off into like the fragment of the remnant that is neo-reaction that's still out there, and the orthosphere. Like, if I was a better person, I would be more orthosphere-oriented. I am much more politically oriented in my thinking, not just in my practices. But it very much overlaps with that, and that's where I think the original, what used to be called the trike of neo-reaction was the traditionalists and orthosphere-type people, the ethno-nationalists, and the tech comms. Now, the tech comms had got defined and partially self-defined themselves as futurist to the degree to which now they would probably be, many of them would be considered alt-light, although I think there was something to the original tech comm consideration in that we're not Luddites, right? And we want to have, like, many of us are sort of like you. I'm not, in not understanding economics, but we want to be economically aware and future aware while also preserving our people and our heritage. So I would conceive of the alt-right as less exclusively focused on ethno-nationalism and more with a crossover where all these things, all these other considerations sort of do map onto each other, and we need to be aware of them because that's what we preserve when we're preserving our people. At the core, at the bottom, at the foundation is that genetic, probably that genetic element. But the thing that unites, or at least first brought all white people into one tent, was more religious in orientation. And I think that once you lose the binding faith, it also leads to this dissolution that we're experiencing as a civilization. Thus the fall away that, for all the problems with Nietzsche as a thinker and Nietzsche as interpreted by others, his realization that God is dead and we have killed him, which does not say God did not exist, but we killed God in our hearts. What, and the next lines that people always leave out has to do with, what will we do to wash away the blood? What sort of rituals will we have to create? What sort of things? And he foresaw the era of bloodshed that was the 21st century. And the shock and horror of that has led to the nihilism of the modern period. And we have yet to overcome that. And I do not think that returning to, say, trying to revive paganism artificially is just following the left that tried to revive paganism starting 30 years ago. I don't think that unites and binds us. Not only that, I don't think it's true, and if we want to be a truthful people, we should be a truthful people. But, and sort of like, then some people latch on to, well, we'll be neo-pagan syncretists and we'll equate Odin with Zeus with whatever. Well, that's also a thing that's associated with terminal societies. Terminal civilizations do that. So people of that, you know, sort of bent will point to, well, in the past there have been, like, you know, the Romans saw the Greek gods as their own. Well, first they conquered the Greeks, and secondly, the Greeks had reached a point where their confidence in their own civilization had declined to where they could not defend themselves. Well, and then so the Romans could cart away the gods, right? So like you said about things that have happened in the past, just because somebody can point to that happening in the past does not mean that it was a good thing. There's problems with it. And I think we do have to be aware of economic issues and the fact that just because we have good genetic code and have had a high trust society does not mean that, like, if only we just had white society, we could do whatever we want and any system would work for us. And then we can hand out welfare programs to the poor and we would not get a situation similar to what happened to the British working classes, in a way that Theodore Dalrymple has chronicled. And that wasn't just a thing. That wasn't just a thing where minorities took advantage of it. That was across the entire foundation of that society.
Yes. Well that's a massive. Whoa, can you mute? I think I'm on speaker there.
Yeah.
That's quite distracting. Okay, thanks. Dalrymple was a massive influence on me. Before I started the channel, I had been absorbing his stuff for about 3 years. And I think I was starting to move away from him by the time I started the channel.
Right.
But definitely between 2011 and 2013 inclusive, I was absorbing his material. And, well, I mean, he was a paleocon, he was a pessimist.
He was not
a utopian, and that was really what gave my channel the color that it had in the early days, like the first year.
Right.
I was trying to be not absolutist. I was trying to maintain an open mind, although on some things I wasn't open minded, things that I'm now more open minded about, which I won't name. But the general point was his general point was that people should employ self-reflection far more than they do. And I've absolutely I've gone farther with that than he has, I think. It's something that I see all the time now, everywhere. And then the other main concern of his is nihilism. I think small n nihilism, which again has been a major part of what I do. He was a massive influence on me, and his whole thing is that, and you know, the something where I depart from him on is that he just wants to moan about it, and yeah. I wanted to moan about it for a while. I definitely did, and I did do that, but eventually you have to start trying to be constructive, because it's not enough just to say, oh, why can't things be like they were 50 years ago or 100 years ago? You have to start being more practical and thinking about the long term, because your descendants are not going to thank you for moping around wishing that things were like they were 100 years before you were born. You know, your descendants are going to thank you for building something that they could rely upon.
You can't just be a Peter Hitchens about it either, and like point, like that just goes with your view, and like point out all the things that are leading to the death of our civilization and shrug your shoulders and say, yes, it's finished. No one is going to appreciate that. And this is why despair is a sin. Despair, and Dalrymple and sort of the paleocons in general remind me of, in George Orwell's book, 1984, there are those gentlemen that hang out at
Chestnut
Tree Cafe, and they just sort of wait for the end, right? And they're like, they're sort of wise old gents who saw the past, but they're not doing anything to change anything, and they've given up on the idea that they could.
Some of them are like that, and others have been literally defeated by the party, which is why Winston is one of them at the end.
Right.
You know, so it's
we can't be like that. Like, I am a natural pessimist, so if I were to be candid about what I think is likely to happen, that would lead to a Dalrymple-ish position. But there's no reason for us to act like that. And I've had to train myself to get away from that sort of like thinking.
It's something I personally can't stand. I'm not strong enough to be like that. I have to believe that things can be improved. I have to believe that.
As long as there's some of us still here, there is a chance, right? Just because I think odds are one thing does not mean that we give up on the chance, because this is another thing that I admire about the Byzantine civilization is, though their last century was spent in internecine feuds in a way, as everybody tried to get the throne because they thought they could do something, in the end, they stood on that wall. The last emperor stood on that wall, and he fought. They fought to the end, and the Turks were all around them. They controlled all the lands around them. They fought. They fought like they had a future in the very end. And even though they went down fighting. And this is why Americans have the story of the Alamo, too. And then this is why the story of the 300, the Spartans at the pass of the 300 resonates through our civilization for 2,500 years, right? Closing in on that. Because it means something to fight to the bitter end. And in the end, the Greeks won. Though the Spartans fell at Thermopylae, the Greeks won that. They won at Salamis with the Athenian fleet, and they triumphed, which means you never give up.
Yeah.
That's the story of our people, is you never give up.
Yeah. And what we have in going for us this time is that we have better technology than, anyone has ever had before.
Right.
And that seems unfortunately trivial. It's a trivial thing to have to rely on. I wish I could say we have better self-belief than mankind has ever had before, but we don't. I wish I could say we are wiser than mankind has ever been before, but we're not. So I can't say that. But we do have the technology.
We're showing the deficiencies of materialism because, like you said, we have the best technology mankind has ever had. If we had the spirit to fight, hey, and I've said this in some of the emails, if we had the will and the spirit to do anything, the invaders wouldn't be coming because they'd know we could wipe them out in an instant if we felt like pushing anything. We wouldn't even have to push a nuclear button. We could just use our drones and they would either stop coming or they wouldn't survive. So our material advantage has never been greater. Yeah, I think our material advantage wasn't even as greater when we, as great as it is now, when we had the Maxim gun and they did not. But they feel the impunity to strike us with low technology attacks. They'll use a truck to attack us, like they did, in Germany this month. Because they know we're not going to do what we are capable of doing, because we won't even stop unarmed men of military age from streaming in long columns.
Yes, and the thing is, I when I see that footage, I find it terrifying, and I don't understand why. I mean, I don't know what Mr. Normie thinks when he looks at that footage.
I don't know either. Mostly he's shielded from them, which is why they showed the image. The camera always focuses on the one image of the waif, Not
the, yeah, it's always the kid.
It doesn't try to show the endless long columns, right? They certainly have, since last year, they have stopped showing almost anything, even though the number of migrants coming has not gone down, right?
Yeah.
Then Mr. and Mrs. Normie, and I love them to death. Mr. and Mrs. Normie want to go on with their lives, and I want to build for them that they can go on with their lives and be able to put aside from their head issues of this great import. But they right now they can't be allowed to. Right now, everybody has to, when you have a puppy and the puppy piddles on the floor, you have to put the puppy's nose in it so the puppy knows what they did is wrong. This is what's wrong. This is what can't be allowed to happen.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. It's an interesting analogy because I do see, some of my relatives. I don't really like the term normie because it is kind of patronizing, but yeah. it is practically useful and accurate. And some of my relatives are normies, really all of them. So it's... I do understand what you're saying, and I wish I could protect them from this. I wish I could protect them from themselves.
Well, I mean it in the same way you talk about the middle class, right? The British middle class and the American middle class is very much the same way in that you talk about them, usually in your videos when you talk about them, it's a tone of not liking what they've led the world to or what they've let happen, basically. But I also know that... you see them as the backbone in a way and as an important element. It's just that they can't be allowed to let things go. And their problem with modernity right now is that your typical person thinks that because they voted, and this is going to happen with Trump if we're not like on it, which I know a lot of people are like on the ball with this. And this is what happens to us each time is people think, and this happened to the Tea Party, they think that once they've gotten voted in the polls, then they can go back to like ignoring everything for 4 more years, right? And then they wonder why the problem isn't solved, why the politicians keep going with the policies that they voted against, you know? I mean, so...
Yes, it has to be a sustained thing. Right. Well, you know, it, more than that, it has to be a cultural thing. It's not enough to... This is a problem that I think it's... I don't know if it's specifically an American thing. I was watching one of my old videos the other day because it sort of came up in a conversation, so I went and watched it. And I was talking about monarchy, and I said that Americans tend to invest so much in a politician because they don't have a monarch.
Right.
And, that's a bit simplistic, but...
It's a lot of it is true, though.
But the trouble is that it leads to what you've just described, which is, well, we voted him in. Why isn't he saving... our world.
It's his job, right? Yeah. We voted for the right people. Well, and I think you're right when you said, well, it's more than that. It also got onto the thing that has also been part of your videos is the middle class like to do what's fashionable, what they see upper middle class and higher class people doing. They find that admirable and they do it. So you get the phenomenon of people like Angela Jolie adopting, you know, people from, you know, children from Africa. And so they think, at least some of them do, most of them don't do this, but enough of them do that it's annoying that we're also going to adopt a baby abroad. Isn't that a nice thing to do instead of adopting a white child here? Right. You know, so
well, this is what I've seen.
The fashionable people are saying that we need to take in these refugees out of compassion. So I'm a compassionate person who listens to NPR or the BBC. So I agree with that. And they don't think that, I mean, they're not thinking that shallowly, but it becomes this sort of like, this is why commercials are able to have such an effect on people, even when the product they're supposedly advertising is a car, but what they're showing is diversity, right? You know? And so the left has realized that it's a great way to manipulate the emotional appeal of your average middle-class person is to show the vibrancy that then they'll think that, well, how could I oppose that? All good people are believing X, so I'm going to believe X because I don't want to be a bad person.
Yeah. Well, that's something that I've noticed recently, just how pliable a lot of people are. I was delighted when Hillary didn't win the election.
Yeah.
Because I could see the endless, relentless attempts by the mainstream media to, well, sell her to the public and convince the public to vote for her. And I was really glad that it didn't work
It's a very incremental process, and enough people are resistant, openly resistant. Here it's Jacksonian America, and Trump is basically the perfect scion of Jacksonian America. He even has the sort of confident strut about, you know, being a Jacksonian American, even though he was born to a rich Manhattan family, right? So you wonder how he acquired that sort of Jacksonianness that comes from the American heartland / hinterland, you know, away from the coasts. But he definitely has that, and he very clearly, though again, he was born into a modestly wealthy Manhattan family. People clearly get the sense that and he went to all the best schools, right? Because they had money. He clearly associates himself more with a sort of a blue collar attitude, you know? So like the part of, like, he exudes a blue collar attitude without ever being a part of that sort of subset of America. And people are both simultaneously aware they're being manipulated, but in America, you know, in an electoral democracy, all you need is like 5-10%, right? And that swings the election, and then one side wins and the other loses, right? So, and then if you get kids in schools for long enough, and then watching certain programs for long enough, well, you're incrementally moving things along year by year.
And if you encourage 20-year-old women 18-year-old girls or whatever not to get married until they're 35, then, well, you've just gained a massive number of left-wing voters, because they will, you know, they will vote left.
Yeah, married women vote right, and single women vote for, you know, leftist stuff.
Yeah. So this is what I meant when I said that it's a cultural thing as well. This is what I mean.
Yeah.
I think that the alt-right should be aiming for that.
Right.
Should be aiming to really change the culture in Western countries. And what's more, I think it would be a really good idea if we targeted Germany first. Because... Well, you know, our opposition targeted Germany first.
No, I know that. And I think this is where technology is our advantage, right? Because right now, the way things are is the establishment would never let us have cultural influence in the major corporations. And they're trying to marginalize us as much as possible. But we can root around still. I mean, your channel is on. People find you on YouTube. Our stuff is on the web mostly, not on TV, and it's not going to be on TV for years. I mean, and some people have talked about, well, I hope in 4 years we can have an X, right, a TV network or whatever. And that's a good aspirational goal. But in the meantime, we're plugging away, and people are tuning in to listen to, you know, TRS. You know,
yeah. I don't give a fuck about the mainstream media. The mainstream media is dying.
It's a dying dinosaur. Hardly anybody watches. Only old people watch it. Right?
I don't think we should be investing resources in trying to infiltrate.
But that's why, technology is our advantage, because we don't have to have a $1 billion corporation behind us. We don't have to have a $1 million I mean, it would certainly help, right? If Peter Thiel wants to fund anybody, even if he's not good on the homosexual question. we'd be happy to have the money, right? But on the other hand, the technology is such that we don't, we can be poor people in a basement somewhere without a studio, running TRS radio from our homes in New York, running a YouTube channel. I mean, we're not neckbeards like people sometimes try to portray it, but we're obviously also not independently wealthy, and we don't need to be,
No. No, this, we know how to do this.
Yeah.
We just need to do it more. But that's the whole point, is that I do think we need to change the culture radically. And that's what I think we should be aiming for. And, well, that's where I think the alt-right should be going. And I am fairly optimistic about it. Right now I'm extremely tired, so I'm probably not going to sound very energetic and upbeat about it. But I am upbeat about it. I think we can do this. And I think we must do it. You know, it's not a joke. It's not just fucking entertainment. No. This is our duty. This is our role in history. We have to do this as much as maybe we'll fail, but we have to try.
We have to try. And we've made a progress in the last year that in ways that nobody expected, and are still small steps, but they're steps. You know, the Brexit vote came out the right way. Now all we have to do is prevent them from stealing it from Britain. Trump won, and Trump isn't done. You know, Trump isn't us, but he's a step in the right direction. Now we just have to keep making steps. If we move things in our direction, and we have to do it much faster than the left because time is running short. But we've come a long way in a year, whereas if we were talking a year ago, none of this would have happened, and we would be talking about what our first step's going to be, right? Well, our first steps have happened.
Yes, indeed.
So, yeah,
Brexit and Trump. And
yeah.
As you say, that Brexit is actually the meaning of Brexit is actually quite elusive. Liberals obsess over it being a racist thing, that the British public are majority xenophobic and so on. I don't think that's the case. I think it's much more complex than that. Similar, they say exactly the same thing with Trump. You know, they'll say that most people who voted for him are racist, they're white racists. I think it's far more complex than that. However, the advent of these two things does speak of some animation in the white soul that has been, well, on the way for many years, decades, because the white soul has been, frankly, dormant for a very long time. And I think that the fact that these things have happened suggests that there is an awakening coming. Or already in the works. So we have to take advantage of that and direct it.
Those steps are just steps away from transnational globalism. And those are important first steps, though. I mean, they're people stepping back from transnational globalism, which otherwise has been a freight train with no stops, right? Steaming ahead, steaming over populations of Europe. And if we can continue to take steps away from transnational globalism, then we're also getting away from the idea that, well, everybody around the world is the same and should be melted into the same, except they get to keep their identities and take over your neighborhoods.
Until liberalism gets to them completely.
Right.
And then they'll be absorbed into that.
Right. So, which will never happen, but which is like why our global elites are like foolhardy to think what they're thinking, but that's okay. Their time will come when they're not ruling. But these are the first steps, and the idea is that we need to continue to keep the pressure on and take the next steps, because we don't have 40 years. We maybe have 5, right?
Yes, I think we have 5, 10 years to do this. But I think we should definitely, we should be behaving. We should be acting as if we have 5 years,
right?
And do as much, achieve as much culturally as we can in that time.
But after like 5 or 6, it starts to reach in many countries a critical mass where, fates are sealed, or we have to do things that none of us want to do, that will stay in our own hands, but would be necessary. And it would be ugly. It would be an ugly outcome. So it's much better to have a gentle.
But hold on a second. Hold on a second. I just have to say, we are not advocating violence of any kind. Right?
No, when we're
you
not.
Say that. We're
no, hoping. I'm definitely not.
No,
I don't want that. I want us to succeed on a good timeline, which is why I don't want any bad outcomes. I am the last person to advocate any, I have seen war enough, in my own life to not ever want that. Mm-hmm. Let me clarify that for sure, which is why we have to act with alacrity, though.
Yeah. And for my part, I would be the last person to be of any use in that kind of situation. So it's not something that I want either. And this is why I say it is a cultural battle at this stage. And that's where I can be useful.
But this is also why the alt-light, the sort of cultural libertines, are not even really close to our thing, because they're in a wrong direction in a way, and they're orthogonal to us while still being opposed to social justice warriors, but they're not on the same path really. Like, some people do come over from that, but they're not pursuing the same cultural end we are, which is the opposite of libertinism.
Yes. Well, I'll be speaking to AJ Sphinx, who at the end of this, he's the last one of the millennial hangouts, and he used to be a skeptic, and he had a skeptic channel, what you would call cultural libertine. Uh-huh. That's what they are in effect. So he started off as that. He had this channel, and then in the course of doing that channel, he converted, as it were, to alt-right.
Right.
So that's a very, that's quite an interesting story, and I'll be asking him about that. As it happens, he was attacked as a sort of apostate or a heretic.
Yeah.
So it's rather an interesting example. Sorry, you were going to say something though before I interrupted.
Oh, no, I just that it's interesting the number of what's occurred, occurred to me, especially over the last year, hearing other people's stories, both on your channel and some others, is what converted. People have come to this from all sorts of directions. So I'm not saying that they're so far enough away from us that people can't convert from it, but just that the cultural sort of what you call the skeptic community, which happens to also be the hyper individualist community, is moving as a whole in the wrong direction. But we do get converts from that. I think what happens is once people have reached any point on the spectrum that is outside of sort of the core mainstream politics thing, they're already open to questions, which means they're also open to different answers. Right. So I've been in my life, like, I grew up as a moderate liberal. Then I became a sort of mainstream but libertarianish conservative. And then I became more of a Ron Paul right-wing Hoppian libertarian. And now I'm with us, right? But I think that the pattern has to do is once you're already thinking outside of the 3x5 card of, like, sort of the establishment, you're open to different things. And so we can get converts from sort of all over the spectrum. I don't think we'll get many converts from actual social justice warriorism, though that has happened also.
Oh, yeah, it has. Now, yeah. I mean, I think the most difficult will be the skeptics.
Yeah.
Because I think the SJWs, for various reasons, I think they will be amenable. Well, it depends on the SJW, obviously. Right. Some of them are just totally fucking demented. But I think the sort of lukewarm ones who go along with it just because it's fashionable, I think they can certainly be persuaded.
Those are easy converts for a lot of different reasons. But yeah, I heard you say the same thing in the tail end of the Morgoth chat too. So that, you know, the skeptic might be the hardest nut to crack in a way.
Mm. Yeah, he seems to be doing quite a lot of thinking about them just now. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to have him on again in future and we can talk about it more in depth. Yeah. But anyway, shall we call it a day there?
Yes, we should call it a day there. I need to let you rest. And
yeah, I don't know how long we've been going. I think it is about 2 hours.
That's yeah, I tend to ramble. I'm sorry. Once I
not at all. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
And it's been great seeing you also.
Yeah, I'm glad that you've been on the channel now. I hope I didn't interrupt you too often, did I?
Oh, no, I hope I did. It's my problem of interrupting others. I think I interrupted you too much because when I get eager, I start babbling on.
No, it's fine. It's your time on the channel, so I shouldn't be interrupting you.
Your channel, I should be good to my host. What the Muslims do is they're not good to their host.
Oh.
Talk about being good to the tradition of hospitality. You have to be good to your host, not just like roll over them like a steamroller.
No, it's all right. I mean, you're welcome to come on again in the future.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, I suppose we'll leave it. This was Porphyrogenesis. You can find him on Twitter. And, well, that's it. Thank you. And thanks to everyone at home for listening. Tomorrow night we've got – hold on a second. Let me see this. Okay, Lana Loctef and then Daniel and then Black Pigeon Speaks. So thanks to everyone, and I'll see you then. Good night.